Now, I will also try to be a little honest with you on like things, issues like backgrounds, which usually don't get covered when you talk about like, you know, to non-experts, because backgrounds are evil and we don't want to advertise these things. So I'll talk briefly about what signal structures and backgrounds could be, and I'll give you a couple of examples with a few caveats on the way what we might be able to do. I should say there's a whole lot of work being done in BSM physics at the LHC, in particular in models which are hard to find. And I won't cover them. I'll stick very close to the main standard bread and butter BSM physics, if you want, which is some variant or something that looks like supersymmetry or whatever little Higgs model. So what do we expect from the LHC? Well, as the theorist, I expect that we find something like a light Higgs. And don't like force me to define what light mean in that case means. And then we hope that we'll find something that stabilizes this light Higgs mass. That's like a theory argument, right? So we want to find something that stabilizes the Higgs mass. And then we secretly dream of producing dark matter candidates in large amounts at the LHC. So if these models which protect the light Higgs mass have some kind of an R symmetry, some kind of Z2 symmetry, then they can have viable Higgs candidates, and that people refer to it as the WIMP miracle, that such particles typically come out to be very feasible candidates, but not the only ones by no means. And then there's a role of particle physics in that new physics, something that was recently called, labeled the inverse problem. Inverse problem is how you extract data from LHC, more physics from LHC data. And you can get to guess what the direct problem might be in that framework. That's the indirect one. So LHC and models, both are actually, at this stage, way too complex for just general model independent analyses once you go beyond, say, Z prime to mu mu or some things which really stick out. Models are complex because, you know, they have to like walk around a whole lot of constraints that we already have a mass, like the flavor sector, or like electric precision data. And the LHC is very complex for the reason I'll show you in a second. So what we really have to do is, we come up and we have to test testable models. We have to write testable models, which means the models have to be worked out and the simulation tools have to be ready to test those. And then we can test different things. We can, for example, find particles and we try to measure quantum numbers. Or we try to find particles and then we might know the quantum numbers, we might not know the quantum numbers. We can nevertheless try to measure the masses, the kind of thing we can do. And then we should look, because LHC doesn't live in a data-free world. There's going to be additional data, like from Planck, direct detection, G-2 data. And you really have to make sure that you combine those properly. So we recently had like slightly frustrating attempt of that. Remember that there's a lot of like, you know, theorems that say like, you know, there's a lot of no-lose theorems between Clebertron trileptons and B-physics and dark matter. And they rely on very specific supersymmetry breaking scenarios. And so with the two friends, I tried to find how much of that correlation between dark matter, direct detection, and Clebertron trileptron rates is left after you basically generalize that problem to the weak scale, TEV scale MSSM. And the answer is next to nothing, which is really sad, because if you believe that it's M subgrad kind of Susie breaking, they're totally correlated. So that's something that theorists have to, are responsible for. Right? We have to make sure that what the statements we make are very, very clear, and they're very honest of what we assume and what we do not assume. And then you get the right answer. At the end of this program, we hope, of course, to reconstruct something like the TEV scale Lagrangian. LHC essentially means minimal luminosity. What makes the LHC such a powerful machine is that it has a huge luminosity. In other words, if you have new particles which are, for example, strongly interacting, coupled to gluons in some way, you produce a whole lot of them. Here's just some cross-section plot here. These are the mass of particles in GeV up to 500. So here, for example, gluino cross-sections. And this is picobarn. So this is 100 picobarn cross-section, typical cross-section. This could mean millions and millions and millions of new physics particles produced at the LHC. So that's going to be a lot of them. And that means we can study them. We can study, for example, their decay structures. On the other hand, because of this high luminosity, the environment of the LHC is hugely challenging, and that is because of the high luminosity, we have things like the underlying event that Rob was talking about, but also we have jets everywhere, jets flying around all the way up the LHC. Any signal that you see will come with a ton of extra jets. How do we look for new physics there at a machine like that? Well, in the kind of models we typically write down, when we want to protect the Higgs mass, we typically come up with some kind of a model that protects the Higgs mass against loop-induced divergencies. And somewhere in these loops, the top, for example, strongly interacting particles appear. And one way to think of these stabilizing mechanisms is that we have to postulate new particles in some way. And these new particles, if they rely on some kind of a symmetry, will include strongly interacting particles, particles that had with an SU3 charge. And those we can produce at the LHC in large numbers because they coupled the gluon. Dark matter is a weakly interacting particle. So in the most generic models where we have new strongly interacting particles and we have a weakly acting dark matter candidate, we will always have signatures which involve jets, because the strongly interacting particles have to get rid of their colored charge and missing energy from dark matter, and leptons or not leptons. That depends on how they decay. That depends on the details of the decay. And this is what people here are, for example, using here. But this is an old CMS Squarcluino search block. They look exactly for depth of missing energy. And so, for example, the Gluino, you know, has to, for example, decay to two jets. Squark decays to one jet and missing energy. ADD, for example, means that one of the ways you can look for a graviton radiator is recoiling against jets. I mean, you adjust jets events and jet events, and you produce additionally a graviton that appears as missing energy in your detector. Now, QCD, the problem is that QCD always comes with plenty of jets. And let me give you an example. If you produce either some toy tops at 600 GeV or Gluino or Squawk, you produce a cross-section just as an all-inclusive cross-section, it comes to whatever, some number of picobarns. And if you now request one additional hard jet, one hard jet above 100 GeV, the cross-section, which you would naively from QCD, which should go down by alpha S over pi, so become very small, really goes only down by a factor of 2. And that is a problem that has to do with collinear logs. These logarithms would be simulated in partial showers. What's interesting is that with new physics, you produce so many jets that you can even trigger on them. So you can just trigger on additional jet radiation, for example. So often enough, if you have a signal that has soft leptons, the trigger on jets radiated in QCD, which have absolutely nothing to do with your signal, quite often hits. What we know from this, we need to understand jets and signals. If you want to extract something in more detail, we need to understand those jets. So how do you describe jets in final state? Well, there's two kinds of jets. If they actually saw what's at the tap on two kinds of jets, the one is hard, high PT, and the other is soft, the low PT, or collinear. Hard jets are described by matrix element, just write down the matrix element. It's perfectly well defined. The soft jets are described by collinear logarithms, and they're described by the partial shower. That's like the Pythia partial shower. And since recently, a few years ago, we have, before the first time, been able actually to combine these methods. So we have now a method that's called jet merging, and that there's two of these models on the market, and they allow you to describe the spectra of jets for all transverse momentum ranges. Now, the signal is very simple. From a QCD point of view, what do we do? Well, we produce typically two particles which are very heavy. So the hard scale in the process is high, right? I mean, the typical energy scale for SUSY production is what, 500 GeV or TeV, so something very high. And then what you do is, well, you decay them somehow, and you try not to cut away in your analysis too much of that. And so your QCD sample that you have knows about these heavy masses, and there's no additional scales. There's no nasty cuts if you try to avoid it. So basically, you can run these kind of signal analysis right through tools like Alpjen, Sherpa, Madevan, where these merging prescriptions are implemented. And you get figures like this here. I stole this from Johan Alva and collaborators. Just Gluino mass, Bino mass, Tevatron, Gluino search strategy. From a QCD point of view, absolutely no problem. After we have understood how to describe them properly. So jets with new physics are fun and they're easy. So we need them, we can actually use them, and they're easy to deal with. Nothing complicated. Let's get different when we talk about background. As Rob said, right? What do we do if we want to understand, well, the physics that's not the signals, the backgrounds? Well, we typically start, we measure W plus jets, Z plus jets, TT bar plus jets. So TT bar is the background. And then they appear all over, and they appear with huge rates. And what we need to do is we need to understand how do W and Z and jets appear in kinematic ranges. We want to look for new physics. So we measure them somewhere, and then typically we have to extrapolate from a kind of background dominated region where we can even measure, for example, normalize our rates. We have to go into the signal region, and we have to see what we would expect from the backgrounds there. And then we subtract them out, or we do our statistics analysis. The problem is, when that comes with jets, this pushing things into a phase-based region where the background does not want to live, the signal region, usually implies bad cuts. So for example, a very simple example is Z plus jets has one energy scale, MZ. Now you calculate Z plus jets and at the same time require some transverse momentum of some jets to be 500 GeV. Just by cuts, you introduce another scale, and you introduce all kinds of hell for your QCD colleagues who have to calculate background for that in those. Parton shower general collinear jets are not a good idea. We should not rely on parton shower to predict backgrounds at BLHG. That's physics of the past. Merging, we should do the stuff I just told you. We should definitely be doing, and so we can describe the jets of the entire PT range. The only problem it has, merging means you can produce like n jets, and you can combine them all. But even any single prediction, still, I mean, it's still leading order. It still has a very large normalization scale factorization scale dependence. So the error bar that Robert's talking about is not going to be very small there. It probably gets the shape right, but the error bars are quite big. To get the error bars down, we have to calculate higher orders in perturbation theory or in alpha s. But those we only know how to do for a fixed scale. So we don't know how to do the higher orders for the kind of merging prescription. So here, QCD and background physics QCD is still making huge progress and needs to make even more progress to get somewhere. And so people do, for example, these higher order calculations. Of course, like when we want to do the higher order calculations to whatever TTBOP and then TTBOP plus jet and TTBOP plus two jets. And this just, you know, just summarizing this a little bit. So signal was always 2-2-2. You produce two heavy particles. Everybody can do this. We did this 10 years ago. Absolutely nothing hard about it. Backgrounds, people currently do 2-3 particle next to order. For example, if you've got a TTBAR jet or 3W calculations. Next thing they're going to do, they're working on is TTBAR. BBBAR was just announced that they have first results. So these are technically infinitely more complicated, and people are getting there. Recent nice application was that people use next thing also, 2 loopy plus or -3 jet calculation to improve the alpha s measurement. So don't tell me this can't be useful. My personal bottom line is, well, jets and backgrounds are tough. And they're boring. Well, I mean, you will never find the Higgs or Susie in the analysis you're doing. Somebody else will find the Higgs in the using what you have done. So I'm very, very happy that other people actually enjoy doing that. And they are making huge progress, I should say. And this is probably the field that's making the most progress right now. Okay. Imagine we measure these particles. What can we do with them? Well, we want to study these new particles which we produce so many of. And as I said, if the new particle is strongly acting, and the LSP is weakly interacting, that we always get some kind of a cascade decay. I just drew a Susie cascade decay here for you. Luino, bottom neutralino, slepton neutralino. That's what we call a very long cascade chain. And cascade kinematics have the big advantage that they're not very sensitive to QCD effects. If you might try to measure something from a total rate, sigma times Roshan ratio LHC, QCD will try to kill you. Whereas cascade effects, you know, these are kinematic endpoints, and radiating a collinear or a soft gluon doesn't do much to them. So what we want to extract information about in these cascade decays are typically thresholds and edges. For example, here's a famous dimuon threshold, which has an upper limit here, an edge, and the threshold is zero. And here's just a couple of examples also from my colleagues. This is how we hope to extract information on these new particles at the LHC. Over the last 10 years, probably, there has been a huge number of suggestions what kind of these constructions you can use. The problem is all of these edges and so on constructions are in some way, they're designed for certain signatures, like, you know, a cascade that's very long, for example, or very short cascade, or something that comes with a gauge boson in the cascade and all of these things. All of them look different because these are kinematic variables, right? So you have to input certain aspects. There's also, like, you know, philosophical ideas. You rather want to fit individual points, like endpoints, or rather fit a shape, right? Both of them have certainly their benefits. And see, here's just a list of the last year what people have worked on. Most of these studies are still at the level that they're parton level, or maybe fast detector simulation, no underlying event in. So, I mean, most of them are still awaiting the final check if that will work in a realistic LHC environment. They're at very, very different levels of sophistication, I should say. So for this long community, Keshe and people have really worked hard to find, get an idea what we could do. And here is, these are the masses in one of our favorite SPS1 parameter point that everybody has studied to death. And this is the error bars, statistics and systematics error bar to the best that our Atlas and theory colleagues were able to simulate. And you see that we can measure, for example, the Guarino mass quite well. You see also that typically mass difference, like here, the squawk mass and Guarino mass, or another mass difference here, have much sharper peaks and absolute masses. Now look at this, look at this formula, and remember that a squared minus b squared is a minus b times a plus b, and you see immediately where that's coming from. The question for us is, though, why do we actually bother measuring physical masses? I mean, who cares about physical masses? Before I try to address this question, here comes my one slide on missing energy. So missing energy is very, very, very hard to do, as Rob already said. And the reason why is that if you want to, one of the reasons, if you want to calibrate electrons on like muon detector behavior when an electron or muon has to be reconstructed, that's easy because there's fairly few parameter cells which contribute to that. Jets do more. Missing energy, you really need to understand your entire freaking calorimeter. And that's a lot of cells. And only if, like, you know, 0.1% of behaving weird, they can cause huge trouble. So here's the figure that I stole. I'm not sure how well you can see it. I can't see it very well. But I stole it from CDF. This is missing energy in early running distribution, which they found. This is 450 GeV. So you see the curve that they measured was here, had a bump here. So that was expected, had a bump here, and had a bump here. So it's clearly a sign of signal for Susie. We can even determine the mass differences from that. And then the first thing is they basically checked, are there runs where you know, the calorimeter was just basically not functioning very well? And if yes, take them out. This took out this part here. The next question was, do we have runs where somewhere in parts of the detector we have coherent noise, you know, something, some electric charge kind of thing, whatever is going on there, some, you know, currents. I have no idea what they do. In any case, if they take this one out, they get rid of this little curve here. And then they even deal with like individually bad cells, which they know don't work very well at the very small percentage level. And then at the end of the day, they did this. They get this kind of curve. So that tells you, you get to judge how much you're going to believe early running missing energy data at the LHC. The LHC is much, I mean, Atlas and CMS are much bigger than D0, by the way. There's recently, by the way, an idea that we might be looking for new physics without looking for missing energy, even though we could. And here comes the second step from a phenobarbital theory point of view. What Rob already said, how can we simulate, like imagine we understand the detector, how can we simulate dark matter or the missing ET spectrum? The problem is the physics background to that is always W and Z plus jets. And that means gauge boson recoiling against jets. And that means we're sensitive to the jet simulation, exactly to this kind of jet merging which I've been talking about, which means to every jet we radiate, we have to describe it of the entire PT range. And the good thing is we can do this now. With this merging procedure, we can do this. I'm just going to show you a figure here that is d sigma by dpt miss. That is exactly the plot that Michelangelo did. This is both for Sherpa. One is the red one here is Sherpa with a regular shower. The upper one here is Sherpa with merging. Now, in Michelangelo's talk, you would see 17 orders of magnitude difference between the two of them. This is largely due to the fact that he's using an old Monte Carlo. So, but you still see that there's easily a factor of two or something like that is still in there, to the best of our knowledge today. So this this figure should, but keep in mind, when you see these plots of Michelangelo, yes, the effect is there. It's not quite as scary as we might think it is, but indeed it exists. On the other hand, we should say we can solve that problem again, thanks to our QCD people. So the one measurement I want to very, very, very briefly discuss is spinman measurement is, what if we could find a Gluino candidate? And I don't know how many of you know this, like the old argument from the 80s. The argument from the 80s is Gluino is a Majorana fermion, a joint color representation heavy, right? So we find such a particle and it can decay through either squawk or anti-quark or because it's Majorana. can as well decay to anti-squark and quark. Now we pick a squark decay that ends up somehow in a charged lepton, plus neutrino, plus LSP, plus whatever. Then the decay through a squark will lead to, for example, a mu minus, whereas the decay through an anti-squark will lead to... Do I have a problem with the fonts only from down here? There must be. You might have, but the arrow is different, okay. So, but when you now produce two gluenos, there's a 25% chance that you have either plus, plus, minus, plus, plus, minus, or minus, minus charge. So like sine dileptons in the Susie sample, there's a sign for gluenos. But there's a little bit of a loophole, and that is true of the glueno is a fermion. So what the question is we want to answer is, can we do more? Can we say more about the glueno than just as like sine dileptons? Can we say it's like sine dileptons coming from a fermionic environment? And the answer is yes. We can do that. We can look at the physics between the endpoints, you know, these curves, how they behave in between the endpoints, and that tells us about quantum numbers. And here's two examples. One is you can compare the supersymmetric glueno with a kind of what a glueno that would be a boson using universal extra dimensions. So you compare with Susie cascade with a Kaluza-Klein excitation cascade, and you get different curves here, for example, for the opening angle between the two B jets in the cascade. And you see they're different enough. Fine. Another one is something that was recently done by Thomas Gregor and collaborators, where they wrote down a composite model of a glueno. So they have like a little Higgs type signal, where the glueno decays largely through third generations. And again, the question is, can you tell in certain distributions, here, for example, lepton B invariant mass, can you tell those two apart? And the answer is, again, yes. So while there's clearly a loophole in this argument, putting in all the additional information we will have at the LHC clearly can close that loophole, and we can learn about whatever particle we have produced much more than just its like sine dileptons. And if it is a fermion, then it could be a glueno. Just one thing, I should give some credit here to the Cambridge group, because the Cambridge group kind of came up with the most elegant way of looking at these kind of distinguishing these models in that asymmetry. Asymmetry of the LHC is always good because because QCD uncertainties drop out. And here's the asymmetry they wrote down. It's basically they produce squawk or anti-squawk plus a glueno, and then they look for a squawk decay here, starting here. They produce lepton-lepton jet. And then they look at the invariant mass of a lepton and a jet, and then wrote down the asymmetry lepton-jet plus, jet-lepton-plus, jet-lepton-minus. And the same thing you can do for a glueno decay, except there you have the additional challenge that you would have to tell a B from a B bar, for example, the charge of a soft lepton inside. But the bottom line is these are very, very powerful tools to distinguish these models. For example, the UED curve always turns out rather flat. And then you have, for example, the solid Susi line here. You can tell those apart. What's interesting is now if you vary the Susi model a little bit, you can also get this line here, but just by switching the mixing angle in this little squawk slept on here. And that means, yes, you can tell them apart, but you really have to be very specific what you want to tell apart. So you go and you write down a model, as I said, you write down a testable model that you want to test with parameters that are fixed in you, or you vary the parameters in a given range. And then you can clearly say, yes, I can distinguish this model from, say, little Higgs model. I can tell UED from Susie from little Higgs models in the glueno signature. I just have to be very specific what I mean when I say this is a Susie model with whatever range of parameters, this is a UED model. Otherwise, I mean, our model bluff friends are very smart, right? They will come up with a model that generically produces all the correlations you see. And I should say there's much more work done on the spin analyses in the recent past. Again, because it's not signature independent. You have to really work it out for the different signatures. And the very last topic I want to cover. Imagine now we have achieved that. Imagine we have measured a whole lot of masses, and we have an idea what the spin of these particles might be. How do we go about extracting the weak scale parameters? So the parameters, just weak scale Lagrangian parameters, measurements could be edges, branching ratios, rates, whatever you need to put in. On top of that, flavor dark matter electric constraints, if you want. We really have to make sure in such an analysis that the errors are all treated correctly, in particular that the theory errors are flat. That's what we found actually was problematic in most of the analysis we saw. If you make your theory errors Gaussian, you hugely overstate what you actually know about theory, about QCD. There's no preference from a QCD standard of view of a K factor of 0.95 or 1.2. At some point, when it's 3, you start to worry about QCD. But within the range, you shouldn't. There's no preference of that. And then you apply this instead of the old, good old grids or the good old fits, you apply that that strategy to LHC, whatever, simulated data. The general strategy, so that was just probability maps of new physics. So we write down a fully exclusive likelihood map for P of data given the model, but likelihood in the sense that you evaluate this over the model. That's the hard part if the model has a high, very large number of dimensions. At the LHCV, we have a specific problem. That means we'll have poor direction. There's always some parameters we know nothing about, so we have to get rid of them. And that you can't do. In a likelihood map, you can't just take out a direction. You can do a Bayesian PDF approach, and you can integrate out such a direction. But that would force you to introduce a theorist bias here as an integration measure over the direction you want to get rid of. Or you can do a frequentist approach, and you could look for the likelihood, a profile likelihood, which is designed to keep all the best fitting points, but it will not allow you to interpret the whole thing as a particle, as a probability distribution function yet. So here you have to decide. But luckily, you can first write down the likelihood map, and then you can find the maxima, and minima. You can look at the structure of your parameter space. And then at the end of the day, everybody can do their Bayesian or frequentist preferred dance. Here's a beautiful example for that. This is a figure I stole from Ben Alanek and collaborators. It's a model I don't like much. It's in Subra. I'd rather see this over the MSSM, but fine. What's interesting here is that you have these three different regions in parameter, through the parameter space, which are basically correspond to different annihilation of dark matter, light Higgs funnel, heavy Higgs funnel, and core annihilation, I believe. Now, you can ask a frequentist or can ask a Bayesian question. The Bayesian question would be, oh no, the frequentist question is first, what is the most likely parameter point? I think it might be sitting here. So light Higgs funnel. The other question you can ask, how does dark matter annihilate or couple? Well, that's a totally different question. That's clearly going to be this answer here. And you shouldn't be surprised that you get in Bayesian frequentists, you get two different answers because you also ask two different questions. And then, I mean, sometimes you're lucky that they give you the same answer, but you don't. There's no reason why they should. So what we do, for example, in the MSSM, we do these kind of analyses. And this is our model parameter space. We shift to, like, you know, the general 19-dimensional parameter space, which means we have to torture the grid a little bit. And then we give an output here, of which I just show you one. So this is the likelihood map, for example, in mu and M1. And here you see the best fitting point, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. What do they correspond to? Well, they correspond to the fact that we have only seen 3 neutralinos. And that means that, you know, in M1, the lightest neutralino mass can govern either the first or second or third neutralino we found. And we are not very sensitive to the sign of mu, so that doubles up. So we have 6 of these maxima. And if you were to plot tan beta, which is a parameter that particularly in the Higgs sector is of huge interest, you'll find that tan beta is largely unconstrained here. The only way you get tan beta is you really believe it's the MSSM and you can fit it to M sub H, the Higgs part. And here, just one example. So now we can do an M1 here. We can this three-peak structure. We can do either a Bayesian or a frequentist analysis. And you see the typical difference. The Bayesian analysis shows one peak here, a second on the shoulder, and a third. And they're kind of washed out. This is because of volume effects. You can't do anything about it. One is at the right correct point, and that's the highest here. The second one is already at 200, the third one is around 350 GeV. And that's a very typical feature of a Bayesian analysis. It will give you the right point back. You see it's the best fit, but everything else is going to be pretty washed out. A frequentist analysis, in contrast, gives you 1, 2, 3, and a fake plot, because it's really much more sensitive to the structures of your parameter space. So if you want to measure kind of the size of the structures you see in parameter space, you definitely want to do this in a frequentist manner. Except the frequentist plot here, by definition, does not keep the relative weight or size of these peaks. It doesn't integrate over anything. It just projects points. So that means that the relative height of these points has no meaning. So what you would look at is that, like, you know, this is the best figure I see, the best solution I see. And if you want to see how good it is, I mean, how broad it is in parameter space, you get this answer more from a profile likelihood. So the MSSM, the MSSM, as I said, is not living like, you know, in the pure LHC world. I mean, there's a lot of additional data that we expect to come in over the LHC era. And obviously, this kind of method we have developed is targeted towards implementing additional measurements. And one of the important questions to answer, for example, is how do you get TEN data? And you can get TEN data from heavy Higgs production, but that's very, very tough because it's a rate measurement, it's a counter measurement, it's very bad. So the first idea we had to try was, can we combine, for example, G-2 data? So what we did, we just assumed, okay, it is the SPS1A data point, but we took current G-2 errors. So we just shifted the central value. What's interesting is that indeed the time beta measurement, which used to be 10 plus minus of roughly 5, got to 10 plus minus 2 just by putting in the G-2 prediction. And what's also interesting is that for all of these measurements, the errors went down after putting into the G-2. This is because the parameters is so heavily correlated that whenever you remove some degrees of freedom in one direction, correlations carry this on into any other direction. That just reflects. The second one parameter we studied is branching value V sub S mu plus mu minus. And with that has a disadvantage that the stop Chargino sector is kind of hard to determine. What's worse is, though, if you just naively use the branching ratio B sub S to mu plus mu minus, it turns out that it's really not particularly useful. I mean, if we scale up the point and we go to a TEN beta around 30, and we don't take into account the theory on F sub FBS, we get a 10% measurement on TEN beta. However, if you just put in a delta branching ratio over branching ratio, so a 7% error on an F sub S, the error increases by a factor of 2. And this is not a particularly realistic number. This is a number that needs a lot of work. So what we think is, that this measurement on F sub B sub S actually means that even in flavor physics, you want to take something like this seriously, you really have to put in some kind of ratios, which the B physicists are very good at defining. Okay, and the last thing I want to say, but the final thing, right, the final thing, imagine you have the weak scale Lagrangian. You have only talked about the weak scale Lagrangian. But of course, as a theorist, you want there to be some kind of a gut or something for a unified model, or at least a couple of scale invariant some rules of masses. So the question is, can we actually run this kind of TEV scale Lagrangian to higher scales and see if anything unifies? And the answer here that figure should suggest is, yes, we can. Except there's no error bars in this figure. This is just the central value because we haven't had time to actually look at the impact of the error bars, which is the crucial part of the entire analysis. So the answer is we have the tools, but we didn't get around doing a careful analysis. But I should say, after 15 years at LHC running, we're going to end up with figures like that. It doesn't have to be SUSY. It could be anything, right? And something goes up, and then we can make a reasonable claim that we have understood something about fundamental physics from the TEV scale, including all the errors and including QCD and really understanding LHC data, then I'll retire happily. So this is my little program for LHC physics or for TEV scale physics in the LHC era. So you look for a new physics signal and be careful with missing energy. I try to illustrate that with this beautiful figure. Avoid getting killed by QCD. Any step you do, you have to avoid explicitly. Make sure you don't get killed by QCD. Then if you're good, and you're lucky, you will measure some kind of weak scale Lagrangian. You can combine this with everything else we know, G-2, dark matter, flavor, electric precision, anything we can put in. And we have the tools to do the principle. We do have the tools to do that. And we determine the fundamental physics. And do not get fooled by people like me who run around give these talks only about talking about supersymmetry. Because supersymmetry is really just a worked out example. And can say this, I always said, I don't believe in supersymmetry, but it's really convenient because when you do this kind of analysis, you need, theory predictions with a certain error bar, you need experimental analysis with a certain error bar, and in SUSY, we have those. So none of the things I said here really exclusively applies to supersymmetry. When I say we compare, in this Luinian thing, we compare supersymmetry with little Higgs with UED. Yeah, I mean, these are three models, one as good as the other. And if that should work out, then I would think LHC can be much more than just a discovery machine, and we'll be very happy people.
Just a couple of short questions. Another announcement is that Nima is going to give the talk now, so we could have the whole morning first part intact. Quick questions, comments? You got everything so clear, right?
Well, yeah. That happens when you do QCD talks.
If you have any question, I'm sure Nima would answer it too.
Okay.
You don't, well, let's thank Tillman again then.